This is The Lucky Country, a weekly podcast brought to you by Schwartz Media, the publisher of the monthly and the Saturday paper, and Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. The Saturday paper's the source of quality long-form journalism every weekend, and the monthly is the country's best magazine of politics, culture, and ideas.
Hi, I'm Richard Dennis. Welcome to The Lucky Country. In this, the final episode of Series 2, I have a long chat with my sometimes guest from the Sensible Centre, Chris Fry, about how evidence, ideology and democracy all battle it out to influence the shape of national policy. But first, I want to talk a bit about neoliberalism. In my latest book, Dead Right, I talk about how neoliberalism has eaten itself. But is neoliberalism really dead? While certainly not everyone agrees, I argue that because there's not a single federal parliamentarian who's opposed to all subsidies and opposed to all regulation, then it's meaningless to talk about neoliberalism dominating our parliament. I'm not saying there aren't conservatives in our parliament, and I'm not saying there aren't parliamentarians that like to deregulate some things and like to cut spending on some things. But for an ideology to exist, it needs to be broadly embraced. And when we look at the current crop of conservative politicians in Australia, we see that people like Minister Matt Canavan, the Federal Minister for Resources, wants to subsidise new coal mines. Well, I like subsidies too. I want to subsidise dental care and aged care and renewable energy. So he and I both agree subsidies are a good idea. We just have a democratic difference about priorities. On the other hand, you've got Tony Abbott, who's determined to nationalise coal-fired power stations and subsidise the construction of new ones as well. That's okay. I'm all right with nationalising some assets, and I've got no problems with subsidies, obviously. So there's no philosophical difference between Tony Abbott and I on those issues. Simply a matter of priorities. He thinks that coal is the future. I think we could spend our money more effectively on other things. So, in Australia today, we've got a whole bunch of parliamentarians who are arguing about whether or not we should subsidise something or whether or not we should cut spending on something, whether or not we should regulate unions or regulate the banks, whether we should regulate when people can die or whether we should regulate the live animal export industry. And that's great. The one thing Parliament was set up to do was to settle democratic disputes about priorities. And if everyone can agree subsidies work sometimes, and if everyone can agree that regulation's a good idea sometimes, that's fantastic in a democracy. We just need the voters to make clear what it is they want more of, what it is they want less of, and what they're willing to pay to get it. I've said it plenty of times in this series, but Australia really is one of the richest countries in the world, and we really do live at the richest point in world history. If we want to have more of something, we can have it. If we want to have less of something, well, we can have it. Figuring out what we want more of and what we want less of isn't really an economic question. It's simply a democratic question. And they're exactly the sort of questions that Parliament was established to answer. My guest today is Chris Fry. Usually he joins me for our short segment on the Sensible Centre. Chris, thanks for joining us again on The Lucky Country.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
Chris, do we need more neoliberalism or less?
I'm not sure. I think what we need is sensible neoliberalism, if I can coin that phrase. And by that, I mean the principles that I agree with. The first of them is to pursue in a sensible way, not in a ridiculous way, but to pursue efficiency. And why does one want to pursue efficiency, either in markets or in government services or whatever? And the answer is because that way you can satisfy more of the needs and wants of the community and have more left over to allocate to other needs and wants.
Yeah, but everyone agrees we need efficiency. How do we define what an efficient preschool system is? Is an efficient preschool one that doesn't cost much or one that does a great job of looking after young kids?
That is the $64 million question. And the answer is both. Because all sides are polarised on this one depending upon both their point of view, ideological point of view, and also on their economic motivation. I mean, everyone who works in the school system asserts that if you put more and more and more money into it, the quality of it goes up. That is rubbish, without any question. It's just rubbish. That said, if you don't have enough resources in it, well, you are going to get suboptimal outcomes, whatever they are. So it's got to be a bit about both. And that's why, you know, in the boring nomenclature of sort of policy, you distinguish inputs from outputs and outcomes. And the other point there is, of course, it's extremely difficult to measure these things, especially when you're asserting long-term benefit. So policy should be, in my view, and I think it is largely, aimed at minimizing the cost to get whatever the outcome that people want is. And I certainly support that from a philosophical, ideological point of view and a practical point of view.
Well, there's two issues there, and I want to explore them both separately. The first one is, well, who gets to say what we want? But before we come to that, let's stick with the measurement problem. Which expert do we trust to tell us whether there's too much being spent on our schools or not enough? What's his or her name, and why aren't they doing their job well?
Well, this is the point. Obviously, you know, there's a whole industry around that. Consultants provide good technical advice, or they provide biased, ideologically driven advice in every subject. You know, many of them do it in the media, commentating, and that's the political debate, if you like, absolutely. And the highly qualified technical experts really get a look in a lot of the time. I think no, unfortunately. Let's talk about another example, which is topical at the moment, which is the merits or not of renewable energy. I mean, Abbott makes comments which are both ignorant and deliberately false constantly. No one ever picks him up on it. There's a legion amount of data. There's a legion amount of experts across every area who could do it, but they don't. Either they're intimidated, the media are too ignorant to even realise and do it. And that's part of the problem, I think. The notion that the quality of debate is not impacted upon by the uselessness of the media, it's something that's obsessed me for decades. It's very poor in Australia because the quality of our journalists is poor often, and obviously there's a lot of bias and a lot of concentration in our media, and I think that's getting worse.
But look, I don't think anyone's going to say the media's at its high point in Australia or indeed around the world at the moment. But leaving the media aside, the argument about whether we're spending too much or not enough on health, or too much or not enough on schools, it's always going to have an ideological lens. It's always going to have bias or prejudice or experience lens. I get in theory that we should be efficient and minimise inputs to maximise outcomes, but whose job is that? Who are we going to trust to advise us on that?
The fund folk at PM&C, Finance and Treasury, actually are in the evaluation business. And a cynic would say, well, that's terrific, but of course none of them have ever done anything other than be in the central public agencies that they're in, so how would they really know? But the answer is you get people of goodwill who are knowledgeable, who have skills in analysis, and you try and get them to think about how to measure these things and how to, you know, bring as much kind of science and objectivity to it as you can, and they do. And I don't think anyone ever claims you can get something right. I mean, like health, for example, to me, the best way to measure that in a national sense is the sort of average longevity. And that has continued to go up for, I don't know how long, a century at least. But within that, are there many areas where we could do better? Absolutely, no doubt. No doubt at all. It's just one of those things. These are big questions, Richard,
but
why we spend so much time debating them.
Yeah, but you're a libertarian and a sometimes neoliberal. Should we rely on evidence to make good decisions, to look for low-cost health initiatives that will increase longevity? So if so, perhaps we ban smoking tomorrow. Or should we be libertarian and think, no, we'll use our policy will allow people to smoke as much as they want, as long as they're not harming other people. If we're going to look for low cost interventions to increase life, there's heaps of them around. But the libertarian in me and the libertarian in you probably doesn't want to prohibit everything.
No, that is precisely right. I think that's an excellent example. I was going to use it as well.
Oh, thanks.
And so, it's all rigged, people. It's all true. It's all insiders, you know. And let's have a look where we've got to in this one. This is a Commonwealth responsibility and a state responsibility. There's a lot of activity in the NGO sector as well. There's pretty good science around, certainly in terms of measuring life expectancy, etc. There's very, very good science and data around that, good analysis. And so what have we got? We've got an amalgam. We've got punitive taxation. I think it's a bit high, frankly, the tax on smoking, but I understand the argument for it. But it's gone too high now, I think. But anyway, and that, of course, is flowing out into a much larger smuggling and counterfeiting trade and everything. But so there's a price mechanism. And the next thing is the step back from banning, which is the social stigma. And that is very big now. When we were growing up, everyone used to smoke, lots of people used to smoke. It didn't matter whether you did or not, but it certainly wasn't bad to do so. Now, it's very rare, especially in the big cities, I think, to actually find people smoking. And that's partly cost, partly health education, I think, and partly social stigma. And that's an example of, I don't think it's deliberate, I think it's a kind of a muddle through basket of measures, and it's worked pretty well. And from my understanding, we've actually plummeted down. We're now a very low smoking country in a relatively short period of time.
Look, it's interesting. I tend to agree with you. I think that most people don't realise that a packet of cigarettes now costs more than $40, and that for a lot of low-income people, a lot of low-income retired people who've smoked all their lives, one of the few pleasures they have in life is now incredibly expensive. And I don't think people realise that the objective of much of that taxation is not to necessarily stop them smoking, but to discourage young people from taking it up.
Yes, now, that aspect as well, that's correct.
But at $40 a packet, it's worked. But it's interesting that we're really willing, if people are worried about equity in the tax system, almost no tax is less equitable than a tax on smoking, because low-income earners disproportionately smoke. But we justify the pain of addicted poor low-income people on the basis that there's benefits for young people who don't currently smoke. Now, we don't usually come clean on how that policy intervention works. We kind of pretend we're trying to discourage smokers from smoking, but the effect of the policy really comes from getting non-smokers to not smoke.
I would agree with that, but equally, it's one of those things. There is no positive apart from the sort of pleasure associated with it. There's no positive at all, which is completely different to alcohol or other recreational drugs, indeed, or whatever. So there's not much of a justification to turn the other cheek. I mean, I think the irony is a lot of people also falsely claim that, there'll be these billions and billions of dollars of avoided health costs down the track. Now, for someone who's been smoking for 40 or 50 years, they're probably going to get lung cancer anyway and die. And as a cynic would say, often they die pretty quickly. And so all of the health costs associated with the last 6 months of life are often avoided by people who smoke too much. And something's going to get you anyway in the end. But nonetheless, I would regard that as a reasonable sort of compromise to myself. I think we're in agreement. I didn't realise that the taxes are too high, and it's one of those things. Now, I think if you cut the taxes a bit, it's obviously a budgetary cost, but it wouldn't matter in terms of the disincentive effect. I think that's already kind of taken hold in our community.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Nick Minchin, former finance minister, well-known economic rationalist, actually made that argument once, that he thought, smoking was, if the cost of smoking was an early death, then as a finance minister, that was a cost he was comfortable with.
not quite the exact words he used, but I think that's the sentiment he expressed.
I think Sir Humphrey was very alarmed about the prospect of smokers not dying.
Well, but I guess what I was going to say is I think that's a harsh thing to say, but there's an intellectual honesty to it. But speaking of intellectual honesty, Tony Abbott had his commission of audit was all about economic rationalism and reducing waste and reducing efficiency but as health minister, he jacked up taxes on tobacco because he thought they worked. But obviously, as prime minister, he got rid of a carbon tax, presumably because he thought it worked. What do you think about the state of neoliberalism in the right wing of Australian politics these days? Do they really want to use market-based interventions, or do they just like, taxing their enemies and subsidising their friends?
Oh, no, I think the latter. I think the whole kind of movement with Thatcher, Reagan, etc., obviously there's ideology behind it, but I actually think it was well motivated in the sense of, Britain was there's way too much public sector in Britain. A lot of it was hideously inefficient. There was plenty of room to improve general equity in the community by dealing with these inefficiencies and redistributing the money into other services, etc. But we are way beyond that now. Obviously, I was as shocked as you to find out that poor old Tony Abbott, when he signed up to the Paris Accord, had been lied to, possibly by a senior official, which I found shocking. but back to this. But so now, for some reason, he's obsessed by coal. I mean, we all know coal's the future, obviously, but... we're now in the preposterous situation where he is demanding that the ludicrous mechanism, the NEG, as it's called, be amended to include the building of a black coal fire power station somewhere up in central or northern Queensland, which is not needed, which is really expensive. Which will make a big mining district, which is teetering on the edge of not being economic, more economic, with taxpayers' funds, simply to win a point against his perceived enemies. That is so weird. And to be fair to the Liberal Party, most of the serious people in there have just gone, no, we're just not going to do that. And even Mr. Canavan, who's, I think it was his initiative. I mean, even he, I think, now realises how ludicrous it is, because it will increase the price of electricity. It's obviously got emissions costs, etc., around that, and it does not improve reliability either.
Speaking of Minister Canavan, I said I wanted to come back to how we set our objectives, and I often make the point these days that Matt Canavan and I have more in common than people realise.
He often says that, Richard.
Not as loudly as I do, but I'm hoping we can do a joint press conference on this at some point soon. But no, I mean it. He thinks that subsidies are an effective way to get new coal mines. I think that subsidies are an effective way to get more domestic violence shelters or dental care. He and I both agree subsidies work. What we disagree on is what Australia needs more of. So how does neoliberalism help us answer the question of what we need more of? How do the experts at Treasury or Finance or PM&C, how do they know what we need more of?
That's a very good question. You take soundings from all the interest groups in the community, and people have their own views, obviously. But then, of course, you have the question of ranking those views, and this is where the question of access and real influence in politics obviously comes to the fore. I mean, the notion that, back to the coal, but building a redundant and ludicrous power station is so absurd. It's just, I was shocked the first time I heard it. But the people who are pushing that, which is obviously the mining lobby and others, to them it's perfectly natural that they would just go in there and provide their orders. And if they're not done, they're certainly strongly considered and grabbed by a minor faction, if not more.
But, I mean, in Australia, we have enormously expensive subsidies for private schools. We have enormously expensive subsidies for private health insurance. We have enormously expensive subsidies for fossil fuel use. How have the Liberals, state and federal, got away with telling people they don't like subsidies? How come Prime Minister and Cabinet Finance haven't reined in subsidies that went to these groups?
Well, can I say, I am certain, I don't see it obviously, but I'm sure that those departments, either singly or jointly, give lots of good advice on precisely the poor allocation of resources that a lot of subsidies give. No doubt about it. Whether government takes it up or not, obviously, is up to them, and that's our system, and that's the proper system. But you're right. I mean, I take the point. I mean, I think that our public finances they've gone from a position of fantastic strength to teetering on the edge of weakness, and we need to do more about it, both on the revenue side and on the expenditure side. But I take your point when we don't have enough money to do X, to build a particular facility or upgrade some hospitals or something. And yet, out of the blue today, tens of billions of dollars can be found to appease Western Australian taxpayers because it's in the political interests of the government. That's clearly a double standard, and you're right, I agree.
I thought it was a fascinating double down from a government who just last week secured enormously expensive tax cuts, with some people saying, how are you going to fund them? It turns out the way they're going to fund them was enormously expensive increases in spending on Western Australia.
Well, that's right. It literally is the magic pudding. And no doubt that will get up. I presume they're going to legislate that in the next, I'm not sure when, but in the next financial year. And therein lies the problem. In the end, sure, there's lobby groups, and they have influence on everybody. And the more powerful you are, the richer you are, normally you get more influence on whatever side of politics listens to. But in the end, the really powerful ones are when there's a major political... not so much a gain, I think. It's more to try and avoid a major political cost that the mind really focuses, and otherwise sensible frameworks become very flexible, And as today is an example, it's been coming for a long time. And of course, this is one of the troubles with competitive democracy. If in China, if they don't like the distribution, I don't know what they do for their internal... financial allocations between the various districts, but whatever it is, I don't think the views of the populace matter all that much when the central committee makes its decisions. It's just one of those conundrums of democracy. The counterpoint, of course, is that the people have listened, the people have made their point. They've been listened to, and whatever the problem is addressed. I mean, it's always a balance.
Well, Chris Fry, thanks again for joining us on Series 2 of The Lucky Country, and I think here in the Sensible Centre, we've come to the radical conclusion that democracy is better than autocracy. So,
we'll take that up next week. Sure.
We'll take that as a tentative conclusion.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Okay, thanks for talking to me, Richard. Bye-bye.
Well, that was Chris Fry. And that's the end of Series 2 of The Lucky Country. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our sponsors, Schwartz Media, the publisher of The Saturday Paper and The Monthly Magazine, and of course the Quarterly Essay Series. And thanks also to Future Super, Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund.